So, have you slept enough times since 2 weeks ago that you've forgotten whatever it is you wanted to ask on 1 Corinthians 7? I guess so. No questions, huh? All right. Well, Paul told me that what y'all talked about last week was more of an application, so to speak, of the principle that's discussed in 1 Corinthians 8, which is essentially putting into practice the admonition of love. And that's certainly relevant to the text, and that's really the overriding theme of Paul's directives here in this chapter, as well as, of course, the crescendo for it is in chapter 13. But in order for us to get a handle on what takes place or what's discussed in the next three chapters, I think it would be good for us to kind of give some serious consideration to the context and the issue that's being discussed. Otherwise, we're probably going to miss some of the important dimensions of this text, especially in chapter 10. As we mentioned early on in our study, and particularly when we started in, when we talked about chapter 7, we noted the expression "now concerning," which seems to indicate that these are the answers that Paul is giving to questions that had been asked in the communique that Paul had received from the Corinthians. These were either questions or issues that had been brought up. And so, if that is true, and I'm fully persuaded it is, because I think we see a dramatic shift in the subject matter from chapter 7, the end of chapter 7, to what we are looking at in chapter 8, that we would recognize that this is a whole new area of concern. Now, basically, what he's going to be dealing with in this chapter, chapter 9, and through the first verse of chapter 11, is idol food. And I'm not talking about IDLE, I'm talking about IDOL. Idols were a big part of the Corinthian life. And I think it's easy for us to appreciate the impact that their previous life had upon their disposition toward things like idols. If you lived in a culture where you essentially ate, drank, and slept idols, and your life was well defined by your relationship to those idols, it would be hard to turn loose of that. I'm reminded of a member of the church in Beaverton, where I preached, who grew up in a denomination. I believe it was Methodist. But in her household, Christmas was a really, really important religious day. And so whenever she learned of the secular nature of the observance of the Christmas holiday in the pagan influence and the Catholic influence, she conscientiously could not have anything to do with Christmas. Not that she would, not that she thought that was inherently sinful, or that anybody who had anything to do with Christmas, if they had a Christmas tree, if they had lights at their house, or if they had exchange presents, she didn't look down her nose at those people. But personally for her, she just had a real difficult time disconnecting herself from her upbringing and her attachment to Christmas. And so it was just easier for her to have nothing at all to do with exchanges or Christmas trees or gift exchanges or anything like that at Christmas time. So she didn't make an issue out of it. But I've often thought about her trying to put myself in the shoes of the people that were in Corinth, where they were coming from and what they were having to deal with. Because, as Paul points out, everybody would acknowledge, basically, that idols are nothing. But it's just kind of like Mary Martha, that's the lady's name. And she wouldn't be embarrassed by me telling this because she told everybody this. So I'm not, you know, divulging any secrets besides you probably won't ever meet her. But anyway, I lost my train of thought. Maybe I'll get it back in a minute. But anyway, these people were in the position of understanding that there was nothing inherent, but for the most part, as Paul mentions here, there was nothing inherently real about idols except that it was such a dominant part of their practices. So I think we need to factor that into the discussion or our understanding of what Paul says to them. He's going to address three basic issues. When we get over to chapter 10, and again, we're going to kind of look at the high points of these three chapters. When we get over to chapter 10, he's going to point out why it is wrong for them to be participating in the idol meals or feast or sacrificial food rituals in Corinth. And so that's going to be something that he's going to deal with extensively. In the first part of chapter 10, about through verse 22. In the remainder of the chapter, down through verse 1 of chapter 11, he deals with it from the standpoint of the food that was sold in the marketplaces. And then in chapter 9, he's going to be defending his apostleship in the light of his practice as it relates to what he says in chapter 8. Now, since he brings up the fact that of himself in chapter 8, in his understanding of what idols are, which is nothing, and that actually the food that they ate in these religious observances was a matter of indifference to God, then the question would come up in their mind, well, why are you making an issue out of this, Paul? Because we're essentially on the same page. And that's the way he starts out his argument in chapter 8, is in agreement with the basic premise. But I think one of the oft-overlooked lessons of our day, and it's one that they were overlooking too, is that knowing something factual, that something is true, just because you have that knowledge, just because you know that, and just because it is a true fact, that's not all there is to it when it comes to the impact that it has upon our lives and our actions with regard to others. And the missing ingredient in so many cases, and it was here, is love. What we know and what we do and how we act must always be within the framework of love. And I'm not talking about the ooey-gooey, you know, kind of sentimentality that is typically associated with love. It's the genuine concern that we have for other people that Jesus talked about when he said to love your neighbor as yourself. That is, what we do and what we think and how we act and how we interact with other people should always be from a motive of true love. And so that was the missing ingredient in their actions that Paul deals with here in this chapter, and also he touches on it again in chapter 10. Now, one of the things that questions that comes up in this particular study of this chapter is, well, is this just about meat that was sold in the marketplaces, or is there something else involved here? And I'm persuaded that the cultic observance of these sacrificial meals is something that is in the background of what he's talking about, that this was still a big part of their cultural religious activity, that is, they being the people in Corinth. And so those who had come out of this are wrestling with what's going on over here in the observance of these meals that are offered in connection with idol worship and all of the various associations with it. And so they're struggling with that, in spite of the fact that they know that idols are nothing. And again, it's because of that upbringing and that attachment to it, and the fact that it was such a huge part of their lives. And so that's why Paul is so emphatic with regard to the attitude that they need to consider. They are in need of a major attitude adjustment. Now, he makes four major points in his argumentation. One, of course, is that, as we've already mentioned, that he would not take issue with the fact that most people have this knowledge, and that is that idols are not anything. There's no real argument there. And then also, that the food that was eaten in these ceremonial feasts, as far as God was concerned, it was a matter of indifference to him. He would agree with that, because that seems to be the argument that they were throwing back at him, or the argument that they were making. And therefore, to them, it's a non-issue. And since they have been baptized into this new relationship with Christ, and he talks about that in chapter 10, then they don't need to even give any concern or have any concern or give any consideration to this practice, because they're not going to be tempted to worship an idol per se. And so they see themselves as being immune from any fallout from this cultural practice. And then, of course, they're going to take issue with Paul, and he's going to have to defend his apostleship, which he does in chapter 9. So these are some of the things that Paul is going to have to get squared away. And the first one is, as we mentioned a moment ago, is that they need an attitude adjustment. So he's going to address that and deal with it here in chapter 8. And then he's going to have to deal with this authority crisis, and we talked about that too, that Paul's apostolic office was under attack, and that his detractors did not respect his authority as an apostle, and that in fact they sort of looked down their nose at him. And he's going to have to address that and straighten them out on that. And then the true nature of idolatry is something that's a little more subtle. But it involves the attitude of people. And he's going to contrast this. It's the attitude of people that there is, how do I say it? That there's no connection between what you do as long as you know the truth on something. That there's just no concern for influence. And the subtle language that is communicated through your actions. And so that's, in chapter 8 and chapter 10, to me, that's some of the most important lessons that we get from what Paul deals with in these chapters. So, with that in mind, let's just, and I don't need to intend to replow any ground that Paul went over last week, but from what he told me, his approach to this was a little more of an application-oriented discussion, which is certainly relevant, and I don't want to minimize the importance of that. But on the other hand, if we're going to get a handle on chapters 9 and 10, we've got to keep the flow of the argument in mind. So, again, concerning things sacrificed to idols. So that would be this idol food. That is the central subject of this these three chapters. And Paul's masterful method of answering arguments is to find points of agreement. This is classic for Paul. He'll find a point of agreement, and then he'll go from there. And so, apparently, they had been saying, look, we know that these idols are nothing. And Paul says, okay, we all have that knowledge. Okay? But something that gets overlooked is that knowledge puffs up. But love is what edifies. So right now we have a comparison here between just knowledge, pure knowledge per se, of what is true and factual, versus the other dimension of one's interaction with people, and that is love. Now, if a man thinketh that he knoweth anything, he knoweth not. Yet as he ought to know, in other words, if a person is just looking at facts, without expanding that. Just, okay, it's black, it's white. Okay, that's fine. But you really haven't arrived at a full understanding of how you put knowledge into practice if that's where you stop. I'm just saying, well, it's black, it's white, it's up, it's down, it's left, it's right. Now, what is the practical aspect of that? Well, that's what they were lacking. And, of course, then the other concern is to bring God into the picture. And if any man loveth God, the same is known by him. And the love of God and the impact of the love of God on a person's life has to be included in the whole package of what a person believes in what he and how he lives. It has to be a comprehensive picture. So now it goes back to this matter of the meat concerning the things that are sacrificed to idols. We know that no idol is anything in the world. Okay? No problem with that. And that there is no God but one. Well, that's what they understood, and Paul's agreeing with them. There's not all this panoply of gods that the Greeks and the Romans had. Everybody knows that. For though there be that are called gods, now he's talking about the idols, whether in heaven or on earth, and that, you know, they had them everywhere. They had some that stayed up there all the time. They had some that were down here. And there are gods many and lords many. In the Greco-Roman world, there appeared to be those that the gods of the heavens that just remained up there. And then there were the cultic gods that, quote-unquote, or lords that were down here on the earth. That seems to be the distinction that Paul is using here, appealing to what their customary understanding of the ones that were up there and the ones that were down here. He said, well, you know, there's a whole bunch of them in their idolatrous pagan environment. Yeah, they're all out there, but again, everybody knows, I mean, the Christians that Paul's talking to here, we all know that they're nothing. And yet there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we unto him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we through him. There's one God and Father, there's one Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So, he has just picked this commonly accepted information, and he said, okay, we're all on the same page here. Now, verse 7. But you know, howbeit there is not in all men that knowledge, but some. Okay. Some being used until now to the idol, eat as of a thing sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Okay. Here's the person that we were talking about a while ago. The one that is so steeped in this traditional practice that they just haven't been able to disconnect themselves from their previous understanding that when you're in this setting and you're eating this meat, that you are, in fact, demonstrating some affinity for this idol. He said, there are some people that still have a problem with that. And so they eat as of a thing sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Because there's still that element of their conscience back there that's saying, you know, this is just not right, and I should not be doing this. And so now they are sinning against their conscience. And as Paul said in Romans chapter 15... chapter 14, in verse 23, the one that doubts is condemned if he eat, because if he eateth not of faith, and whatsoever is not of faith is of sin. If a person willfully sins against their conscience, they're sinning, even though the act itself may not be inherently sinful. If you are demonstrating a willingness to violate your conscience, that is sinful. So, these people that have this problem, their conscience being weak, it's being defiled. Now, again, he goes back and he agrees with the argument that the detractors would make, and that is, well, Paul, you know that food is nothing. As far as our relationship to God is concerned, God is indifferent toward that. Yeah, I know that. Okay. Food will not commend us to God, neither if we eat are we the worse, nor if we eat are we the better. So, again, he picks this point of agreement, but here is the missing element. But take heed, lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to the weak. So here is the stumbling block principle. And this, to me, is one of the overarching lessons of this text and also in chapter 10. We must all, in fact, love, I'll just put it this way, love will always be concerned about its influence. And he said, you certainly understand that you do not want to become a stumbling block to a weak person. He's already identified who the weak one is. That's the one whose conscience is weak that he just talked about. So here's the situation. If a man see thee who has knowledge sitting at meat in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be emboldened to eat things sacrificed to idols? He's going to look at you and he's going to say, well, you know, if Ken can do it, then it must be okay. I'll go ahead and do it because Ken's doing it, but yet he is still violating his conscience because he's got that hang up. And so I have now caused him to violate his conscience. And what have I done? I have caused him to sin. For through thy knowledge, he that is weak perisheth, the brother for whose sake Christ died, thus sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Now, I've heard it said, well, I'll just tell you who said it, because he's not around here anymore, but Brother Thompson said there is no relevant application of this that he could think of today in our culture because we don't live in a culture where there are religious practices to which this principle can be applied. But my response to that is the principle goes beyond mere religious practices. I am fully persuaded that there are a number of areas of our lives where we must put this principle into practice. So, how about you? Can you think of any situations where this principle needs to be something that is a governing and overriding, controlling force, if you want to look at it that way, in our behavior toward other people and our concern for them? What if any, is the application that we would make of this principle of influence? You thought about it? Is there anything that you can think of that somebody might see us doing that would cause them to do something that would either be a violation of their conscience or, in fact, might even influence them to commit sin? Rick?
Whiskey and honey. And then I thought, well, if I have a bottle of whiskey in my cup,
And my question, too, to the person who advocates that is, how are you going to get that whiskey in your house? Are you going to buy it? Well, I mean, you might put on a disguise and sneak into the store. I think that's a good illustration. There's nothing inherently sinful about a drop of alcohol going in your mouth, swallowing. There's nothing inherently sinful about that. But certainly, as you pointed out, we know that drunkenness is sinful. That's very clearly stated in the Scripture. There are many warnings in the Scripture about the effect that alcohol has upon a person's judgment. You don't have to be falling down drunk to have your judgment impaired by alcohol. And I can't think of anything good that comes from social drinking in terms of the influence that you have or the example that you're setting. And so, therefore, I think that's a very relevant example of what we're talking about. You know, and people come back and say, well, there's nothing wrong with drinking a glass of wine, you know, when you're having a nice meal. I'm not arguing that the imbibing of a glass of wine is the sin. Let's think about the influence, the possibility. If there was just, well, look at what Paul said in verse 13. If meat causes my brother to stumble, I will eat no flesh forevermore that I cause not my brother to stumble. He said, if this is going to be even a potential problem, then I'm just going to forget eating meat. I would not want to run the risk. I would not want to even the remote possibility of causing somebody else to stumble. He said, if that is an issue, count me out. I am not going to eat any meat. Why wouldn't it be the same with alcohol? If there is even the remotest possibility, all of the arguments that you hear about one glass of wine or one beer and all this kind of stuff, but if there is even the possibility of having a negative influence on another person for the cause of Christ, why would a Christian even want to entertain the idea? That's my question. I can do it. Somebody said something about great places where we go, Al.
Well, the one that I used to play darts. But the only place you can mainly play darts is a bar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I had to stop doing that because that could influence or even with the people I'm with say that, well, how could he be a Christian if he's going to bar? Or even somebody that's a Christian see him.
Mm-hmm.
They would think that as something that I regularly do and it's okay.
Yeah, if it's okay for Al to go to a bar, it's okay for me to go to a bar. And again, what kind of an image is left in people's mind? It's often been thrown up to me, though, well, you know, that's their problem, it's not mine. But that's not what Paul said. He didn't say, well, you know what, their problem is they just need to get with the program and understand that there's not a fraction thing wrong with eating meat in these settings, and they need to get over it. But that ain't what he said. He said, I'm the one that has the ability now to take the action that could possibly influence these brethren for good. That's what my responsibility is. And you look at Romans chapter 14, as we did recently when we studied, and you look at this chapter and also in chapter 10, the strong brother, the knowledgeable brother or sister, is the one that is always directed to take the initiative in behalf of the weaker one. But in our culture and our way of thinking, it's just the other way around. If he's weak, if he lacks the knowledge, if he's ignorant, that's his problem. Let him deal with it. But that is the exact opposite of what love does. Love says, no, I am going to do what I can for the good of the other person. And that's the very issue that Paul's dealing with here, is what, how does love act in these circumstances? And that's what he says. Because love edifies. Knowledge and just saying, oh, it's my right and I know what, you know, I know what God thinks about it and I'm going to do it my way. He says, no, that puffs up. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And I'm not sure how many Christians order their lives on that premise, on the basis of that premise, and it is, what can I do today to edify somebody? What can I do today to edify my brother or my sister? Do I ever get up in the morning or when I jot down my goals or whatever I do, do I consciously make the decision that, you know, I'm gonna do something for somebody else today that's gonna edify? I don't know. Do we regularly do that? Now, this is not time for any true confessionals. But do you suspect that is a common practice among us? Dorothy?
I didn't want to answer that, but I wanted to throw something else into the mix that I'm kind of curious about. That person you said that couldn't think of a modern-day example of how this would affect us, do you think maybe he was thinking, because you're saying how we influence other people, but most people that I work with and know that are so-called Christians would never think there was anything wrong with having a drink. They don't consider that a sin in any way, shape, or form, along with many other things.
Yeah.
So do you think he was maybe thinking of, like, I can see as even the future, in the next 10 years or so, with the young people and stuff, that a lot of these things that would influence people wouldn't even impact them anymore?
No, he wouldn't. No, I talked to him about it enough to know that wasn't his position. As our culture continues to deteriorate at a very rapid rate, we become more desensitized. We as a culture, people become more desensitized. But that's nothing more than Satan's way of getting a firmer grip on people's minds and hearts. In terms of alcohol, you know, you can go back in the Proverbs and look at all that's said about the dangers of alcohol. So whether or not a culture approves of it and practices it doesn't change what the Lord has said about the danger of it. Nancy? And I think every situation, a person has to judge, make a determination for himself as to what he thinks his influence is going to be in any particular setting.
Because that makes the Christian become a smaller and smaller group if we continue to isolate ourselves from every social activity that has sin involved.
Right. And, you know, Jesus, you know, he ate with the publicans and sinners. And he was accused of being a friend of publicans and sinners because he did eat with them. So it behooves us to make sure. And again, every person has to conscientiously make that determination, judgment for himself. But we can't go live on a desert island and be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Nor, on the other hand, can we just idly meld into all of the corruption and degradation that's around us and keep our mouth shut and hide our light under a bushel. So we have to make sure that we do what we can to positively influence others. And the setting is going to have a...
Some woman somewhere used to believe you had to have a hat on. If you had a woman here who thought it was a sin for women not to be wearing hats, should we all wear hats? Because she would feel like it's a sin. That's something that's not here or there, but if it mattered to her, wearing a hat or not wearing a hat, you know, it's like you me, not you me.
Well, you know what? That's not in the historical past. Well, and it's still quite relevant to some places in the South, and particularly in the South. But in that case, you've got to... Well, it depends on the person, because I've been in a congregation where there were some women of that persuasion. Now, the difference comes in if a person is trying to bind their opinion on others as a matter of faith, then you've got a problem. But the women who are convicted of that I've been associated with, that were not the militants, said, well, for me, this is what I do, but I'm not going to say that you're sinning if you don't do it. So... In that situation, it was not an issue. They did not feel compelled to bind their persuasion on other people.
And yet, if they felt awkward being the ones to wear the hats or whatever, and they felt like, well, maybe I just won't wear it, but I feel bad that I'm not wearing it. I mean, that to me is more of a parallel where people who don't see it as a problem might say, you know, I don't care, I'll wear a hat, you know, until you can get to feeling like it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, in that case, though, you've got a facade of accommodation, I guess you want to call it, that a person's really not being true to their conscience or their convictions.
If they weren't true to their conscience, it'd be a sin.
Yeah. So.
But they did it because Betty didn't think that you need to wear a hat. Well, Betty doesn't think so. So I don't wear a hat. And if Betty calls her a sin.
Yeah.
I understand what
I'm doing. I do too. Yeah, because I've been there. I've been there.
I know.
I know what can happen. Yeah. Right. Let me just throw this one in. You know, if we were to go to a culture where women, all the women, wore certain garb, I don't know whether they, you know, had their face covered or have their head covered or whatever. Huh? In order to keep from offending them and their cultural practice. And I think, well, Paul, when Paul says in chapter 9, and we're getting ahead of ourselves here a little bit. In chapter 9, when he said, I became a Jew that I might gain the Jews, to them that are under the law, this is verse 20, as under the law. Essentially, what Paul's point here is he accommodated himself to the cultural situation so that he could have a positive influence on people. And so if it's a matter of embracing a cultural practice to keep from offending people, then it would be good, I think, to put that into practice. Jim, you had your hand up.
The Greek people who Paul is interacting with were not Christians. Like when he went to Mars Hill and spoke.
Right.
Did at that time those people believe that those gods were gods, or did they believe they were a series of tall tales like Paul Bunyan or Wild Pickers Bill? Or, you know, which way did the culture believe at that time?
That they were gods.
That they were true gods and weren't just stories.
Yeah, and for the most part, you know, who knows what every single person believed, but yeah, for the most part, they believed that they were deities.
And the idols that are spoken of, those were idols to those gods.
Right. Now, when Paul says in verse 1 of chapter 8, we know, then he's talking here about the Christians. He said, we know. Yeah, we know that they're not. But then there were those that still had, as we talked about, the hang-up. Well, there come some of the classes in. We will proceed next week. There's a real possibility that I might not be here next Wednesday, but we don't know. I'll mention that in a minute.